The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. James Blind producing, Dave King engineering in Portland, Pedro Bartes producing and engineering in Seattle. Today we'll hear from Andrew Farley, author of The Grace Message, Is the Gospel Really This Good? That's coming up in the second hour of today's program. But first, look at some of the day's headlines. The National Transportation Safety Board told reporters on Tuesday that before anyone can think about cleaning up the debris from now collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, the focus will be on the families and those impacted by the tragedy and the devastating events. The chair, Jennifer Homendy, gave reporters an update during a press briefing earlier today, though she prefaced the briefing by saying she wouldn't be answering questions on fatalities, deferring those questions to local agencies. Instead, she said the NTSB will step back to allow the Coast Guard and others involved in searching and rescue efforts after the major bridge was struck by a container ship and collapsed at about 1:30 a.m. Tuesday morning. According to the reports, the Dolly, that was the name of the container ship, had been flagged twice for deficiencies between 2015 and 2023. It crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore early Tuesday morning, was flagged for two deficiencies between those years. Equisys reported that the Dolly had 27 recorded inspections from April of 2015 through September of last year, during which time there had been two deficiencies found. I'm not sure how uncommon that is or common. On November 27th of 2016, the records show that the ship was flagged for hull damage impairing seaworthiness. Then in June of 23, the ship was flagged for an issue categorized under propulsion and auxiliary machinery and subcategorized gauges, thermometers, etc. Well, during two other inspections later that day in San Antonio, Chile, there were no other deficiencies reported. The most recent inspection conducted on the ship, according to records, was done by the U.S. Coast Guard in New York on the 15th of September 2023 with no deficiencies reported. We do know that the power had gone out. We saw the lights flashing before the accident actually happened. A family assistance team was on site to help families, friends, and loved ones of those affected by the collapse. There are six known to be missing, but it's not at all clear if there were vehicles on the bridge that may also have missing passengers on board. As far as the number of cars and workers on the bridge at this time of the collapse, Homendy said that the information needs to be verified. She said she doesn't believe anyone is thinking about the next steps of cleaning up the bridge and getting things ready until we get past this stage. But given the temperature of the water, the length of time, it's not likely there will be survivors. We will continue to follow the story as it develops and pray for those who have been directly affected by this tragedy. Well, today the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the U.S. Food and Drug Administration versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, along with Danco Laboratories versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, regarding the FDA's removal of critical safeguards allowing near unfettered access to the chemical abortion drug mifepristone, half of a two-drug protocol used to end pregnancies in early stages. The case centers around the FDA's sweeping deregulation of the drug in 2016 and again in 2021. These changes included allowing the drug to be used through the 10th week of pregnancy rather than through the 7th week, allowing healthcare providers who are not physicians to prescribe the drugs, and allowing the drug to be prescribed through telehealth appointments and sent through the mail. The FDA made these changes despite the drug's questionable safety record. The Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, a group of pro-life doctors, argued the FDA's actions in both years, 16 and 21, were unlawful, and state that all six judges that have opined on the merits of this case in the district court and in the appeals court have agreed. The district court ruled the FDA's actions were arbitrary and capricious and blocked the FDA's 2000 approval of the drug and all its regulatory changes. However, the appeals court ruled that it was too late for AHM to challenge the FDA's approval and kept the drug on the market, but upheld the injunction against the FDA's more recent changes. Well, the case raises questions in three areas. Whether the AHM, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, has Article 3 standing to challenge the FDA's actions on behalf of a member who may be injured at some future time by those actions. Number two, whether the FDA's actions were arbitrary and capricious. And number three, whether the lower courts erred in ordering a preliminary injunction of the FDA's 2016 and 2021 actions based on the court's review of an incomplete administrative record. This is what the court is considering. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelager, she argued on behalf of the administration that the FDA deregulated the drug based on its scientific judgment that the drug was safe. She also argued that the AHM did not have standing to bring the case because the doctors do not prescribe the drug and therefore are not regulated in any relevant way under FDA's decisions here and stand at a far distance from the upstream regulatory action they are challenging, end quote. However, attorney Aaron Hawley argued on behalf of the organization that by its own admission, the FDA made regulatory changes to mifepristone with inadequate data, which violates the Administrative Procedures Act. On the issue of standing, in which the justices questioned throughout the 90-minute hearing, Hawley stated that evidence satisfies Article 3 requirements. Well, Article 3 is satisfied here because, one, the FDA relies on the OB hospitalists to care for women harmed by the abortion drugs. Two, the FDA concedes that between 2.9 and 4.6% of women will end up in the emergency room. And three, the FDA acknowledges that women are even more likely to need surgical intervention and other medical care without an in-person visit. Well, the justices focused their questions on who has standing to bring this case, whether conscious protections for doctors already apply, and how to appropriately tailor a remedy. And while Justice Neil Gorsuch and Amy Koenig Barrett, they seem skeptical that the organization had satisfied standing under Article 3, both Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito were skeptical of the government's argument that people not regulated by the FDA have no standing at all. Justice Alito stated, "Your argument here is that even if the FDA acted unlawfully, nobody can challenge that in court." Prelager, the representative for the government, essentially said no, while noting there are too many intervening events and independent decisions for a third party to raise a case, and that AHM had not come within 100 miles or proving cognizable harm that justifies an injunction against the FDA's decisions. To that, Hawley stated in her opening argument, doctors will be forced to manage abortion drug harm is not a bug in the FDA system, but part of its very design. Ruling against respondents standing here would allow federal agencies to conscript non-regulated parties into violating their consciences and suffering other harm without judicial recourse. Well, several justices asked how conscious protections may apply in this case. The government argued that conscious protections are already in place for doctors who object to treating women in the abortion process. However, Hawley noted that the emergency nature of treating a hemorrhaging woman leaves doctors not knowing whether they are treating a miscarriage or an elective abortion until they are scrubbed in and with the patient. What harms our doctor is completing an elective abortion, stated Hawley. Well, Justice Elena Kagan asked Hawley about how the FDA's actions connect to the conscious inquiries. Hawley noted that the doctors saw a measurable increase in emergency room visits from abortion drug harm. It went on from there, but most observers suggested that the Supreme Court signaled it's likely to reject that challenge to access to that abortion pill. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Georgene Rice. Coming up later in the program, a conversation I had with Andrew Farley, The Grace Message. Is the gospel really this good? That's coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. Again, returning to the headlines, a judge, Juan Merchan, on Tuesday imposed a gag order on former President Donald Trump, barring the former president from making statements about potential witnesses, prosecutors, court staff, and jurors, and the trial related to the alleged hush money payment. Well, New York District Attorney Alvin Bragg was excluded from the order, which comes weeks before jury selection is set to begin on the 15th of April. By the way, your taxes are also due on that date. Trump is facing 34 counts of falsifying business records over his alleged involvement with a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. While solidifying his vice presidential running mate Tuesday, RFK Jr. just made himself the second biggest villain to the left. A lunch break panel talked about the fact that making this announcement was certainly not favorable to those in the party he used to belong to. In fact, he was asked if, in fact, his candidacy was to hurt Joe Biden, would he consider backing down? And he said no. Independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy announced Tuesday that attorney and tech entrepreneur Nicole Shanahan will be his vice presidential running mate heading into the November general election. He's only on the ballot in one state thus far, but some of the states require you have a vice presidential running mate before you're eligible. A native of Oakland, California, the 38-year-old Shanahan is a philanthropist with a long history of donating to Democrat and left-leaning causes, including supporting President Biden in his 2020 election bid before switching to Kennedy when he launched his own run for the Democrat nomination last year. Kennedy announced Shanahan by praising her insight into how big tech uses AI to manipulate the public, her athletic ability and willingness to be a partner in a number of policy areas, including on securing the border. Shanahan initially dropped her support for Kennedy after he decided to run as an independent, but later got behind him again by giving $4 million to the super PAC that boosted his candidacy with John F. Kennedy themed campaign ad that ran during the Super Bowl in February. Shanahan also previously donated to Democratic presidential candidates Marianne Williamson and Pete Buttigieg during the 2020 presidential race and threw more than $150,000 behind progressive Los Angeles District Attorney George Gascon's 2020 election bid. She's the founder and president of Baya Echo Foundation, a private firm that describes its mission as focused on new frontiers in reproductive longevity and equity, criminal justice reform, and a healthy and livable planet, end quote. Shanahan was previously married to Google co-founder Sergey Brin, a marriage that ended following reports she had a relationship with Tesla and ex-CEO Elon Musk, which isn't really relevant. She has one daughter from that marriage. Well, following her divorce, she met another individual who works for Bitcoin software company Lightning Labs. The two participated in a love ceremony last year to celebrate the commitment to their relationship, something just shy of marriage. Shanahan's wealth and ties to major donors would likely benefit Kennedy as he aims to improve his fundraising efforts. The Islamic extremist group ISIS took responsibility for a terrorist attack in Russia on Friday that left nearly 140 people dead. The deadly incident is one that the United States should take extremely seriously, according to national security expert Robert Greenway. The deadly attack confirms that the level of threat to the United States from terrorist attacks has not been at this level for decades, Greenway, a former member of the National Security Council and director of the Center for National Defense at the Heritage Foundation, said in a podcast. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan provided ISIS with the opportunity to regain strength, according to Greenway. The predictable outcome of the withdrawal, Greenway says, was that our terrorist adversaries in Afghanistan would exploit $83 billion of equipment and infrastructure left behind and resurrect the capability to conduct operations abroad, end quote. Now, with thousands of illegal aliens crossing the southern border daily from all over the world, America's open borders constitute a grave threat, he went on to warn. Well, the message being delivered by the Mexican president to the United States is none too subtle. Pay up or else. For those who haven't been under a rock for the last 4 years, it's well known that we've a southern border in name only. Obviously, it was one of the priorities, the president's handlers, to open the border and bring in just as many prospective voters as they possibly could under the guise of asylum. After all, who needs a border when you can simply fly individuals into the country's interior, which has been done some, 302,000 times. Still, the overwhelming share of our undocumented workers came across the Mexican border, and with many of them crossing through from other nations, it's been a contention for years that their various cartels, which began as drug smuggling operations, have branched out into another lucrative field, that of trafficking people across the border for a hefty fee and or loan, with severe penalties for non-payment. or in some heartbreaking cases, severe penalties like gang rape and forced prostitution as payment. Yet because the migrants are entering the U.S. from another sovereign country, their cooperation or lack thereof helps to determine our success in border security. It takes two to tango, if you will, and all of that. But with the leadership thought to be in the pocket of the cartels, it's difficult task made even more difficult by Americans' lack of effort. As he prepares to leave office later this year, part of the farewell tour of Mexican President Obrador, better known as by the initials AMLO, I'll use that, landed in front of a CBS News correspondent for an interview with 60 Minutes. It wasn't enough that he remarked that Donald Trump couldn't close the border because he needs Mexico as a place where manufacturing is done more cheaply, claiming cars would cost up to $15,000 more if Mexican assembly plants weren't closed. Indeed, since it was hammered out during the Trump years, the USMCA trade deal has made Mexico our leading legal trading partner. What was most infuriating was how AMLO blamed the fentanyl problem on American addictions. Noting that fentanyl production wasn't limited to just Mexico, he asked, "You know why we don't have a drug consumption that you have in the United States? Because we have customs, traditions, and we don't have the problem of the disintegration of the family," end quote. Well, he's got something there. Obviously, it's a healthy family unit that illegally sends its children to a foreign land to send a few dollars back home. But while billions of dollars are already remitted to Mexico every year from these intact families, AMLO has even loftier ambitions. Some may call it a blackmail list as a price for cooperation. Writing at National Review, Luther Ray Abel did a fine job assessing AMLO's demands. Well, Obrador's list of essentials before he'd consider lifting a finger to control migration includes the United States committing $20 billion to Latin American graft, lifting sanctions on Venezuela, enabling a leftist dictator, ending the Cuban embargo, propping up another leftist dictator, and legalizing Mexicans living in the United States. Those are his list of demands, actual demands made to the administration. Yes, it is insane, and it's no wonder Abel may have only been partly joking when he suggested the Biden administration, after looking at some maps, should consider directing the U.S. Army and the Air Force to level Mexico and install Ted Cruz as governor of our newest state. Knowing this administration, though, they order a strike on Texas instead. Well, meanwhile, those who are willing to wait out AMLO in hopes that a better deal may be disappointed, as this has been noted a few weeks back, Claudia Sheinbaum is the odds-on favorite to be Mexico's next president. She hails from the same party as AMLO and even followed a similar path to power, serving as the head of the Mexico City's government before seeking the national post. So if you can't get two to tango, at least in November, we can get one side to stop dancing, at least for a while. But he made an actual list of demands before agreeing to even talk about cooperating. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the Francis Scott Key Bridge along I-695 in Maryland collapsed into the Baltimore Harbor following a ship strike early Tuesday morning, setting off a search and rescue mission for those who plunged into those chilly waters. A live stream of the bridge at about 1:30 a.m. showed a cargo ship colliding with the support beam, causing the bridge to break apart and fall into the Patapasco River. Multiple vehicles were on that bridge at the time, but no update on casualties has been offered yet. Eight members of the construction crew that was doing routine work filling potholes on the bridge fell into the water. The Secretary of Maryland's Department of Transportation told reporters. Six of these members were unaccounted for, while two were rescued. One of the rescued members was in hospital, while the other refused treatment. When asked about how many vehicles were into the water and the condition of those people that were in the vehicles, was simply told there's no information available at this time. Officials are continuing to respond to the catastrophic collapse as the active search and rescue mission, and that will continue for some time, with the U.S. Coast Guard searching for any survivors in the water. The water below the bridge is about 50 feet deep, and the water temperature is about 47 degrees, at least at the time of the collapse. When asked whether the ship lost power before striking the bridge, the governor of Maryland, Wes Moore, said that the ship's crew alerted authorities about a power issue before the impact. The Mayday call came soon enough that the authorities had time to limit water traffic under the bridge and vehicle traffic across the span. The Baltimore Fire Chief James Wallace said at least two people were pulled from the water following the collapse, with one of them in serious condition. He said authorities may be looking for upwards of seven people, but he said that number could change. The cargo ship that hit the bridge was the Dali, a 95,000 GT Singapore-flagged container ship. The Maritime and Port Authority of Singapore confirmed there were 22 crew members on board at the time of the incident. The collapse comes just 2 days after the 47-year anniversary of the bridge's construction, which was completed in March of 1977. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. Coming up later in the 5 o'clock hour, a conversation with Andrew Farley. The grace message, is the gospel really this good? Well, Sean Combs' Los Angeles home was raided on Monday by Homeland Security officials. They've confirmed agents were also seen at his home in Miami. Early today, Homeland Security investigators New York executed law enforcement actions as part of an ongoing investigation with assistance from HSI Los Angeles, HSI Miami, and our local law enforcement partners, the Homeland Security investigation said in a statement at the time. We will provide further information as it becomes available, end quote. A U.S. official confirmed that the raids on P. Diddy's home are connected to a federal human trafficking investigation. It's unclear if the rapper is the target of the federal agent's investigation. Earlier today, he did say, "I am innocent and this is a witch hunt." It will continue. The New York City Council is asking the state's highest court to reserve ruling that struck down a law that would let non-citizens vote in local elections. An appeals court in February ruled the election law passed by the council in 21 unconstitutional. The law would have let upwards of 800,000 green card holders vote in local elections. The council passed Local Law 11 of 2022 to enfranchise 800,000 New Yorkers who live in our city, pay taxes, and contribute to our communities. Council spokesperson Rindy Desmores said in a statement, today's filing to appeal the Second Department's recent decision seeks a determination from the state's highest court that the law is consistent with the state constitution, election law, and municipal home rule law. Well, after its passage, the law was challenged by Republican lawmakers. U.S. Representative Nicole Malliotakis, a Republican who represents Staten Island and a plaintiff in the lawsuit, said, there is nothing more important than preserving the integrity of our election system. And this unconstitutional law that has been struck down in two consecutive wins only diminish the voices of our citizenry, she said Friday in response to an immigrant activist group that is also challenging the earlier ruling. I urge the city to not waste more taxpayer money to join this appeal and instead focus on the needs of hardworking New Yorkers who are facing so many quality of life, public safety issues, end quote. Well, the legal challenge comes as concerns increase over the influx of asylum seekers in the city, which has strained public resources and put renewed attention on the crimes involving migrants. A number of black lawmakers have chosen not to endorse one of their Democrat colleagues running in what could be one of the most closely watched Senate races this year after he used a racial slur last week. During Thursday's House Budget Committee hearing, Democrat Representative David Trone, who is running to replace retiring Maryland Senator Ben Cardin, used a disparaging term for black people while speaking about tax policy with Shalanda Young, the director of the Office of Budget and Management, who was testifying before the committee. Despite apologizing and claiming he misspoke, meaning to use the term bugaboo, Representative Barbara Lee, the Democrat from California, Yvette Clark from New York, Gregory Meeks of New York, Joyce Betty of Ohio, and Jasmine Crockett of Texas, who are all black, announced their support for Trone's Democrat primary opponent, Price Georgia's county executive Angela Also Brooks, would be their focus. The Mexican government has claimed in court, a court filing, that a Texas anti-illegal immigration law currently being challenged by the Biden administration would, if enacted, impinge on Mexico's sovereign right to determine who enters the country. Mexico filed an amicus brief last week in support of the Biden administration lawsuit against Texas Senate Bill 4, an anti-illegal immigrant law that would allow police to arrest illegal immigrants and allow state judges to order them deported. The law was signed by Governor Greg Abbott in December, but has been on hold due to a challenge from the Biden administration, which says the law is unconstitutional, hurts international relations, and impedes upon the federal government's enforcement of immigration law, which, of course, they are not enforcing. Texas has argue that the law is necessary due to the Biden administration's alleged failure to secure the southern border and enforce immigration law. In its brief, Mexico argues that the law, going into effect, creates a substantial tension on the U.S.-Mexico relations, as if there wasn't already tension there, including trade, and could also lead to discrimination against Mexican nationals. Mexico is deeply concerned that Senate Bill 4 will be applied in a discriminatory manner and fears that its enforcement will lead to improper harassment, detention, removal, and criminalization of Mexican citizens and individuals of Latino appearance, the brief reads. However, it also expresses concern that the law would result in the removal of illegal immigrants to Mexico, regardless of their nationality and without regard for Mexico's own policies regarding entry into its territory or the non-citizens' desire to enter Mexico. Abbott has said that his state can still use trespassing laws to stop immigrants who enter the U.S. illegally, just as February border numbers were announced, showing that there was a record number of encounters for the month. Even without Senate Bill 4, Texas was the legal authority to, has the legal authority to arrest people coming across the razor wire barriers on our border, and we will continue to use our arrest authority and arrest people coming across the border legally, the governor said on Wednesday. The practice of major news organizations hiring ex-lawmakers, government officials, and political insiders has existed for decades and has largely been non-controversial. The purpose, particularly for TV networks, can vary from relying on experts to opine on certain topics to allowing diverse viewpoints to discuss the news of the day. But the polarization of American politics and the increasingly liberal groupthink that has taken over newsrooms have upended a company's ability to make such decisions without workplace drama. And that is currently unfolding at NBC News. On Friday, NBC announced that it had hired former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel as a political analyst for all of its platforms, including for its staunchly liberal sister network, MSNBC. It couldn't be a more important moment to have a voice like Ronna's on the team, NBC News political chief Carrie Budoff Brown said in a memo to staff. That memo may be the only warm welcome McDaniel would receive from her new NBC family. NBC News reporter Brandi Zadronsky took to social media on Saturday to distance herself from her new colleague, saying reporters have no control over the opinion or pundits section. Ahead of McDaniel's NBC debut on Sunday, Meet the Press, moderator Kristen Welker, she expressed a similar sentiment, telling her viewers, "I was not involved in her hiring," and that she was conducting a news interview with the former RNC chair, who Welker said had booked to come on her show weeks ahead of the network's hiring decision. Following Welker's tense interview with McDaniel, where she was grilled over her alleged actions in trying to block the certification of Michigan's election results in 2020, NBC News veteran Chuck Todd immediately took aim at the network honchos. MSNBC's Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, they criticized the on-air condemnation on Monday, making it clear that McDaniel would not be welcomed on Morning Joe. Deadline White House host Nicole Wallace similarly sounded off against her employer. MSNBC's Joy Reid offered a verbal lashing toward McDaniel for her role in rejecting President Biden's victory. Of course, they spent years now suggesting that Donald Trump's election was, in fact, illegitimate. She argued opposition toward McDaniel isn't about partisanship, citing her MSNBC colleagues Nicole Wallace and Michael Steele, as well as vocal Trump foes Adam Kaczynski and Liz Cheney, as Republicans she approves of. As Rachel Maddow, MSNBC's biggest star, blasted NBC's inexplicable decision to hire McDaniel and expressed hope that the network would reverse its decision. An NBC insider said there is already active consideration in cutting ties with McDaniel following the unprecedented reaction to her hiring. NBC's ongoing debacle mirrors the turmoil other news organizations faced when they platformed Republican staff opposed. Last year, CNN staff openly revolted when it welcomed former President Trump for a live town hall. You simply should not be forced to work with, hear from, or consider the thoughts of those with whom they disagree politically. Interestingly enough, by the time we came to the microphone this afternoon, NBC had relented. They have backed away from that appointment and said that she would not be working for the network. I heard one commentator suggests that she will sue them for breach of contract, defamation of character, and a whole list of other things for which he will probably be successful. Nonetheless, the inmates are apparently running the asylum. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll continue to look at the news. And then in the 5 o'clock hour, Andrew Farley, the Grace Message. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, the recent deadly terrorist attack in Moscow has brought renewed attention to ISIS-K terrorist organization. It's not only the U.S. and other European nations, but to extremists watching. It's really good for recruiting for the Islamic State to conduct a show that it can launch attacks to show that it has reach. Bill Raggio, he's a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and founding editor of the Long War Journal, speaking in an interview said, any wannabe jihadist may be motivated by attacks such as these. This is the type of attack that is effective. We're talking about it, and that means something. Reports have indicated that the Russian authorities are sending a message to other extremists after the men appeared in court showing signs of extreme physical abuse, and videos surfaced on Telegram of at least two of the men being tortured. But Raggio argued that the move is unlikely to be successful in actually deterring terrorist attacks. The videos will be used by ISIS for future recruiting as well as to harden current members against Russia, the security expert said. The Islamic State will use these videos as proof of the brutality of states like Russia against Muslims. Well, ISIS-K first caught international attention in the U.S. following the 2021 bombing of Abbey Gate during the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. But the group largely stayed out of major headlines until earlier this year after it took credit for twin bombings that were carried out during a January memorial ceremony for Iranian General Qassem Soleimani that killed 95 people and injured more than 280 others. Sometimes these groups operate in the shadows, but just because we don't see them doesn't mean they've left, Raggio says. It just means that they become more visible. It indicates that the Islamic State has a reach far greater than some people originally thought, he added. They're not just confined to Afghanistan. Well, he pointed out that Islamic extremists have launched numerous attacks in Russia over the last 30 years following Moscow's military operations in the Middle East, South Asia, as well as other parts, areas like the Caucasus, Chechnya, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, or there are large Muslim populations. They're trying to punish Russia for its presence in countries that the Islamic State considers to be Muslim countries, considers to be countries that should be under their purview, he said, emphasizing that to the Islamic State, we're all enemies. The United States, Great Britain, France, Russia, China, to them, we're occupiers. We are all, in one way or another, a great Satan to them. White House National Security Advisor John Kirby said the U.S. is remaining vigilant when it comes to the threat ISIS poses to the U.S. and pointed out that Washington alerted Moscow to the possibility of such an attack weeks ago. Russia apparently didn't listen. Many are raising questions about the southern border and who's crossing that border, who shouldn't. Well, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution demanding the immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages after the United States abstained from that vote. The remaining 14 council members vote for the resolution, which was proposed by the 10 elected members of the body. The resolution demands an immediate ceasefire for the ongoing Muslim holy month of Ramadan that leads to a lasting truce. It also demanded the immediate and unconditional release of all the remaining hostages held by terror groups in Gaza since Hamas' October 7th massacre, which saw thousands of terrorists burst into Israel, killing some 1,200 people and kidnapping another 253, mostly civilians, many amid horrific acts of brutality. Well, Netanyahu agreed last week to send the delegation to meet with U.S. officials regarding Israel's intent to carry out military operations in the southern city of Rafah. But the prime minister's office has decided to call off the delegation's visit because the U.S. did not use its veto power in that resolution, damaging the relationship between the United States and Israel. But it's really not much of a surprise given the back and forth and the shift from the administration in this election year away from supporting our ally in Israel toward those who in Michigan and other states have the capacity to upend the president's reelection bid. Well, there's a lot to consider. Well, President Trump's first of four criminal cases will be held on October 15th, we have learned. The former president will stand trial then on charges related to hush money payments meant to cover up claims of marital infidelity. A New York judge ruled on Monday, tersely swatting aside defense claims of prosecutorial misconduct. Assuming that date holds, the decision from Judge Juan Merchan ensures that the prosecution will be the first of four criminal cases against the president to reach trial. And there are three others. Trump pled not guilty last year to 34 felony counts after allegedly covering up $130,000 in hush money payments made to Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. Again, he has pled not guilty, but the court will decide whether or not that is in fact the case. Meanwhile, the president of Mexico is claiming the majority of fentanyl is being produced in the United States, and the triumphant USA is now producing more oil and gas than any nation ever has. Well, that's according to the Telegraph, but lots of people are finding it hard to believe that's the case. Well, the U.S. Energy Information Administration said in January the U.S. domestic production of crude oil for September 2023 set a new all-time high of 13,247,000 barrels per day. Well, that fact probably deserved more notice than it received, given that it was the most oil any nation on Earth has ever managed to produce in a single month. Well, the high-tech, modern U.S. oil and gas industry is completely transformed. Even more remarkable is the fact that U.S. producers managed to break the record in November and then exceed the September number again in December. Well, the most current month for which full data is available. It is likely November's all-time record of 13 million barrels per day has been exceeded at least once again during the first quarter of 2024 as productions and producers find ways to wring more production out of each well bore. Well, that ability to increase per well performance through the application of more effective processes and advancing technologies has been pretty crucial to the ability to raise overall production, given that the upward curve has continued even in the face of the active rig count that has dropped by over 25% in the last 15 months. The United States' dominance has not held of late. And also, eight states are planning to ban the sale of gas-powered cars entirely. The sale after Biden unveiled his ambitious plan to phase them out by 2032. At least eight states are planning to ban the sale of new gas-powered cars in the next decade, and others are considering joining them. Now, the question is whether or not we actually have the infrastructure to pull that off. Only zero-emission vehicles can be sold in participating states beginning from 2035 model year, according to the Advanced Clean Cars 2 legislation. The rule, which was first adopted by California, means that automobiles and dealerships would be banned from selling new cars, new gas cars, in those states from that point onwards. Americans will not be forced to take their gas-powered cars off the road, however, and will still be able to buy used and secondhand gas vehicles, and presumably vehicles from other states. Well, these states have gone further than the latest federal legislation announced last week, where the Biden administration released new rules to gradually phase out gas cars by 2032. Well, the new federal legislation requires automakers to reduce the tailpipe emissions of new vehicles by around 50% from the model year 2026 onward. In order to achieve this, the Environmental Protection Agency is targeting 35% to 56% of vehicles needing to be EVs by 2032 and 13% to 36% needing to be plug-in hybrids by that date. It was initially proposed that two-thirds of all cars sold by 2030 would need to be EVs, but the brakes were put on that plan last week, given a concession to car makers and giving them more ways to comply. But car makers will eventually stop making full gas-powered successors to the beloved muscle cars of the 1960s and 70s under Biden's new edict. That is, if it stands, if he has a second term. For the time being, though, Dodge announced earlier this month that the 2024 Charger will be available as a gas-powered muscle car, as well as a new all-electric vehicle. According to personal finance site Money, California was the first state to adopt the Advanced Clean Car 2 rule, which will put a complete ban on new sales of gas-powered cars by 2035. Plans in the state, which is run by Governor Gavin Newsom, at least for now, specifically specify that 35% of all nuke sales will need to be zero emissions by 2026, rising to 68% by 2030. And again, the question remains, is there the infrastructure for that, not just whether or not there are sufficient stations to charge your vehicles, but whether or not the infrastructure of the roads, bridges, overpasses, and so on can bear the weight of those vehicles, as well as parking garages and so on. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the next, well, really through the election, and then in the months ahead, depending on the outcome. All right, we've got news coming up here at the top of the hour when we return a conversation with Andrew Farley, the Grace Message. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Well, my next guest has written a book you need to read. It's called The Grace Message. Is the Gospel Really This Good? Well, the ministry that's dedicated to proclaiming the love and grace of God with boldness and clarity, Pastor Andrew Farley, he believes there's no greater message needed today than the message of God's grace. Now, in the book titled The Grace Message, Is the Gospel Really This Good? From Salem Books, he shares how grace turns everything upside down. Now, when you think about grace, do you think about it having an impact on every area of your life? Well, he says that lots of people are getting a lightweight understanding of God's grace, and it's only for them forgiveness when they fail and heaven when they die. They don't see the empowerment of God's grace. So we're going to talk about the grace message with Dr. Andrew Farley. He's a best-selling author of 9 books. He serves as president of The Grace Message, a nonprofit Christian media ministry dedicated to proclaiming the love and grace of God with boldness and clarity. He hosts The Grace Message with Dr. Andrew Farley every weeknight and Sunday afternoon on Sirius XM satellite radio and on stations across North America. He's also the lead pastor of The Grace Church and has been recognized with several awards for his excellence in teaching. He lives in Dallas with his family, wife and son, and we're just delighted to have him here with us today to talk about this extraordinary book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Well, this is such an important subject, and you would think within the Christian church, this would be like the thing everybody understands, clings to, and recognizes as, the golden ticket, if you will. That's a poor way of putting it, but I think you get the idea. Why yeah. is it that we have to be taught and retaught to understand and embrace and fully enjoy the benefits, the lavish grace that God has for his children?
Yeah, well, we grow up going to school, we work hard and they give us good grades, and we go to the workplace and give it our best effort and they give us a promotion. So we're very much accustomed to an achieving system. And then we come to believe in Christ and we now are engaged in a receiving system. It's the opposite, the polar opposite of what we experience on planet Earth. And so grace turns everything upside down. It's not about our trying. It's really about our trusting. And it's not about what we're doing for God. It's really about what he did for us. So it's counterintuitive. It's an assault on the ego at times. Mm. And we just have to be receivers of God's grace.
You begin with an exploration of the Old Testament law, which is perhaps where some of our confusion comes from. And you contrast that with the New Covenant. Can you give us a kind of a brief overview of the two different systems and, you know, the fact that we're under the New Covenant, the benefit we enjoy because of what Christ has done?
Yeah, I don't think we realize how stringent and even impossible the law really was. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was 613 commands staring us in the face, everything from dietary laws to ceremonial washings and sacrificial regulations. And, you know, we tend to think of the Old Testament law as 10 rules written on stone, but it was much larger than that. And for a reason, I mean, Jesus comes along and basically shows that it's impossible. Hey, you think you're doing good avoiding adultery. I tell you, if you look with lust, it's the same thing. And you think you're doing great just avoiding murder. Well, I tell you, if you get angry with someone, it's the same as murder. He's raising the bar and showing the impossibility of true law keeping so that they would realize their need for God's grace. And, you know, God's grace is the polar opposite. It's not us trying our best to get close to God and stay close. It's, in fact, the idea that Jesus made us close through the death, burial, and resurrection. Everything is free to the believer. We're forgiven for free. We're made righteous for free. We're brought near to God for free at no cost to us because it cost Jesus everything.
Absolutely everything. And then you have the Pharisees and the teachers of the law that heap tradition and all sorts of rules that were never intended on top of the law, making it even more impossible, but somehow believing that if we just add more to it, if we just try to clarify it in our own strength, then somehow we're going to measure up to what Jesus himself declared is an impossible standard.
Yeah, I mean, what they were doing was they were adding things that were achievable for them personally, and then they were creating loopholes and they were creating exceptions and addendums and that sort of thing to try to make it palatable and doable. And, you know, the New Testament reveals if you keep the whole law and stumble in one point, James says, you're guilty of all of it. Galatians says you're under a curse if you're under the law, because cursed is everyone who does not obey everything. So the law is not multiple choice. It's not choose your own adventure. It's not like a buffet line at your favorite restaurant. The law is an all or nothing proposition. And that's why we need God's grace instead.
Now, let's begin by defining grace. How is it different from mercy or even forgiveness?
Well, I mean, mercy is when you're driving down the road at 100 miles an hour and the police officer pulls you over and says, hey, I'm not going to give you a ticket today. I'm going to show you mercy. But if he pulls out a $1,000 bill and hands it to you, that's grace. I mean, grace is ridiculous. It's over the top. It's just excessive and beyond measure. It's undeserved favor. And that's the difference between grace and mercy. But I think the average Christian, we're just looking at grace as, well, forgiveness and heaven. You know, God's a banker that canceled my debt, and he's a travel agent that has booked me for heaven. But God's grace is bigger than that. God's grace also means that God is a heart surgeon. He took out our heart of stone, gave us a new heart, filled us with new desires, gave us his spirit. So God's grace is equipping. And anybody that throws stones at God's grace or wants to lessen God's grace is going to lessen their victory over sin.
Now, what is the new covenant and why is that so important? We've talked a little bit about the law and how impossible it is to live up to the standards there. And, you know, I think a lot of people question, well, why were they put in place? We know that Jesus explained to expose the fact that we can't achieve, you know, God is so holy, his standards are so high, we cannot reach that standard. Well, let's talk about the new covenant and how that somehow reconciles us to God in ways that the law never could.
Yeah, so the promise of the new covenant is actually older than the old covenant, and a lot of folks don't realize that, but I mean, obviously the promise given to Abraham was that he would be the father of many nations. And that's what the new covenant is. Jesus Christ was lifted up on that cross. He begins to invite anyone and everyone to come to him. Whosoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. And when we're saved, we enter into the benefits of this new covenant. And it's not our promise to God. It's actually God's promise to himself. Hebrews tells us this. It says God could not swear by anyone greater, so he swore by himself. And we learn that the new covenant is basically God promising God. So on one hand, you've got the faithfulness of God, and on the other hand, you've got the faithfulness of God. And that's what locks us in. That's why we're saved and forgiven and righteous, because God has promised himself to keep us secure. So the old covenant was their promises. God, we're really going to do it this time. We'll rededicate. We'll recommit. We'll obey everything, Lord. And it was a story of failure upon failure. And that's why the new covenant is so radically different. It's not about our promise keeping. It's about God's promise keeping to himself.
I know that you, when you've presented the message of grace, sometimes it's interpreted as being dangerous, that it is a cheap grace that you're referencing, that it gives people a license to sin. Can you respond to those objections? And we'll go a bit deeper in that area, but why do people fear the notion of grace as the scripture describes it?
Yeah, when people call it dangerous grace, I like to say, well, yeah, it's dangerous to the enemy. If you get a hold of God's grace, Titus 2 says the grace of God teaches us to say no to sin. The enemy doesn't want that. The enemy wants you looking at rules, trying to engage in rule keeping, being scared of God, trying to impress God every day with your actions. That's not the gospel. So grace is dangerous, but it's only dangerous to the enemy. Somebody says it's cheap grace. Well, I don't get that because, as we said earlier, it cost Jesus his life and it's free to us. So there's no place for cheap grace. And then, you know, people will say it's hyper grace. I like to say, yeah, I'm pretty hyper about it myself. And the New Testament even uses the prefix hyper multiple times to talk about God's grace, that it's excessive, it's over abundance. The overabundance of grace is, it's off the charts. It's amazing. And then lastly, I would just say, you know, people are saying grace is a license to sin. Well, aren't we sinning just fine without a license? As I look at the Christian world, here we are afraid of God, trying to impress God, trying hard to work for God to get in his good graces. We're in this achieving system, and yet we're failing and we're sinning just fine. So what if we gave God's grace a chance? I mean, Jesus said, whoever's forgiven much loves much. And do we believe him on that? That forgiveness and grace and the kindness of the Lord, that's what leads us to repentance and motivates and inspires us.
We're talking this afternoon with Dr. Andrew Farley. He's a pastor and author of The Grace Message. Is the gospel really this good? Well, the answer clearly is yes, but do we get it? Well, the book is all about helping us understand what the scriptures teach, and that changes everything. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Again, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. I'm continuing my conversation with Dr. Andrew Farley. He's a best-selling author of 9 books. His latest is The Grace Message. Is the gospel really this good? And the answer, of course, if you've read the scriptures, if you know Jesus, yes. But do we dramatically underestimate the value and the virtue of grace in the life of the believer? And I suppose the answer to that is also yes for many of us. How is grace connected to the gospel message? And in coming to Christ and recognizing what he's done for us, how does that connection help us better understand the value and the virtue of grace?
Yeah, well, grace is not a special focus. It's not a special emphasis. Grace is the gospel itself. I mean, we're told in the book of Acts that the gospel is called the gospel of grace. That's Acts 20:24. We're told elsewhere that God has given us grace upon grace, that Jesus is full of grace. Romans says we're standing in grace. Titus 2 says the grace of God teaches us to say no to sin. I mean, we could go on and on. There's dozens and dozens of passages showing us that grace is the very core of the gospel. In fact, it's what differentiates Christianity from world religions. I mean, the common theme in world religions is you do your part, you work your hardest, God will grade on a curve, you try to get clean and get pure and get right through your obedience, and maybe, just maybe, you will satisfy the deity. And that's what we see in world religions, with a founder and a rule book, and you keep the rules and you're in good standing. If you fail to keep the rules, you're punished. And that's religion, but that's not what Christianity really is. Christianity is about relying on the work of another, the finished work of Jesus Christ. He hung on that cross and said, it's finished. And then, of course, we learn through the New Testament that salvation is free. By grace we're saved.
Well, I think this is one of the areas where there's confusion. We know that legalism is opposed to the grace message, but what role does obedience play? We know that we're not earning our salvation. We're not earning favor before God, but we are called to be obedient. How does that fit into the grace message and the grace that we enjoy in Christ?
Yeah, so God's grace is equipping. And when we were saved, it was more than a ticket to heaven. It was more than an invitation to attend a building once a week on Sunday morning. It was actually a heart surgery. You might even say a DNA swap at the core of our being. He took out our heart of stone and gave us a new heart. Romans 6 says that new heart is an obedient heart. And that's the connection we need to make. Look, I can be forgiven and yet miserable. Mm-hmm. I can be righteous and yet miserable. So why do I want to be miserable in choosing sin? I've got this new heart. There's only one thing that's going to satisfy me. And so I'm going to prove that God is right about me. I'm going to prove it by sinning and being miserable or by trusting Jesus and being fulfilled. But either way, I prove that my heart is an obedient heart. I'm addicted to Jesus. I'm allergic to sin.
Hmm. I think when we come to recognize the depth of God's grace that, again, he lavishes on us, our heart's desire is to please him out of gratitude and love rather than that sense of obligation that so often drives us to be legalistic.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm either waking up Monday morning and deciding I'm going to behave today in order to earn points and achieve status and get the certificates redeemable in heaven's gift shop, or I'm waking up Monday morning realizing, you know what, Father, you've told me I'm your child, that I'm new-hearted, that I'm dead to sin, alive to God, that you've got the market cornered on satisfaction, and I believe you, that you're good. So today I'm going to taste and see that the Lord is good. And if that's my motivation, well, that's healthy Christianity.
What does it mean to die to sin? We struggle throughout our lifetime because we still are in the flesh. What does it mean to die to sin? And what role does grace play in the working out, the sanctification that is part of the life of every believer?
Yeah, so it's interesting because when we actually look at this phrase, die to sin, it's used in past tense for the believer. So this happened to us at salvation. I mean, Galatians 2:20 says, I've been crucified mm-hmm. with Christ, and Romans 6 says, "I my old self died. Paul even says, you died to sin. How can you live in it any longer? So that's that heart surgery I was talking about a moment ago. I may not realize that I have a heart surgery that's occurred. I may still think that I'm the same as the guy next door. I mean, that guy next door, he lays awake nights dreaming of new ways to sin. And then here you and I are talking about ways to not sin. So we're spiritually, well, we're aliens in this world. We're not a good fit with a fallen world. And so if I could just wrap my mind around the fact that it's not just that Jesus died for my sins. I died with Jesus. And when I died with Jesus, I died to sin's power. And that means sin doesn't have to have dominance over me anymore. I can say no to sin, and I can say yes to who I really am. But there's a process there. I mean, you're right. I'm learning and I'm growing in that truth. I don't have perfect understanding. And so God says we'll be transformed by the renewing of our minds. But let me just clarify one thing mm-hmm. that I think is really lacking in the average person's understanding. This doesn't mean that my heart is wicked and deceitful and all those things that we like to say. No, you've got the new heart. What you need is new attitudes, new perspectives, the renewing of the mind. So it's like software and hardware. When you bring a computer home, the hardware's new, but you still might need some software updates. Well, likewise, we've got the new spiritual hardware as believers, but we still need some software updates, the renewing of the mind.
Yeah, I think some of us are carrying around the corpse of our sin nature, not realizing we have been crucified with Christ and we live in him. How can we live in God's grace? What are some practical steps that you would suggest for those of us who want to live and embrace fully all that God has for us?
Yeah, so, you know, we could bring sin nature into it because you mentioned that. I mean, so I had a great talk in 2009 with Zondervan, the publishing house. They published my first book, and I said, hey, look, you guys have the NIV Bible, and you are perpetuating this sinful nature verbiage, and it's not actually in the original language. Would you look at that again? And sure enough, they did. After 2 decades of it being in there, they changed it back to flesh. And I think that's important. It's not just semantics because, you know, what we need to tell believers is you've got a new nature. your new spiritual nature is that you're one spirit with the Lord, and yet you've got the stinking thinking, and that's what the flesh is. It's stinking thinking. It's old attitudes. It's remnants of that old self in your attitudes, but the old self is gone. So you need to be reprogrammed in your mind, let go of fleshly thinking. And you ask me about, you know, what's the best way forward? Well, you fuel up. I mean, you fuel up on God's truth and you fuel up on God's grace, and you set your mind on the goodness of God and the goodness of the gospel. And I think if we learn who we are in Christ, then we can be ourselves and express Jesus at the same time. I mean, we're not an obstacle to God. We're his instruments.
Yeah, that's good. Now, what do you say to people who don't believe that God's grace is as good as the Bible says? My first suggestion would be read the book and then read the book. But how would you respond to one who isn't convinced that God's grace is as good as the scriptures say?
Yeah, I think they need a heavier dose of law for about 15 minutes to come to their senses. You know, if we're going to say God's grace is not this big, then what's our answer? Go back to the law and you'll quickly find Jesus said, cut off your hand, pluck out your eye, be perfect like God, go sell everything in order to enter the kingdom. I mean, Jesus showed us the stringency of true self-improvement. He showed us how impossible it was so that we would realize our need for God's grace. So when somebody says, no, no, it's not all about grace, or no, no, God's grace is not that big, I would just invite them to go examine the law again and come back when they're done, because when you see the law in all of its impossible glory, then the grace of God shines even more brightly.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Jesus said he fulfilled the law. We're so blessed to be free from the burden of all that was in it. Well, Dr. Farley, I thank you for the book, and I thank you for taking time to join us here today. Once again, the book is The Grace Message. Is the Gospel Really This Good? The answer, yes. Published by Salem Books. Thank you so much, Dr. Farley.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the Portland-only segments of the Georgene Rice Show. Well, former President Donald Trump's bond has been reduced to $175 million in his civil fraud trial. And while that sounds like a lot to me, apparently it's not as much to him. Well, the court had previously set the bond at $464 million. That's half a billion dollars. But a New York appeals court ruled on Monday to reduce the amount and give the former president 10 more days to pay the funds. Now, Kirk, putting this all into perspective, pointed out that Bernie Madoff, $10 million bond for orchestrating the largest Ponzi scheme in history, defrauding 40,000 investors of billions in savings. Sam Bankman-Fried, $250 million bond for defrauding thousands of crypto investors out of billions of dollars to finance donations to Democrats and anti-Trump Republicans so they'd look the other way. Donald Trump, $454 million bond for paying all of his loans. Well, the bank he defrauded testified in his defense and said it would love to do business with Trump again. No victims. Well, this is the most Soviet-style injustice ever perpetrated in American history, and it's not even close. Now, that doesn't mean you have to favor Trump, but this practice could be broadened to include, you know, your ox that's being gored. President Trump's first of four criminal cases will be held on the 15th of April. The former president will stand trial on the 15th on charges related to hush money payments, well, alleged hush money payments, as they say, meant to cover up claims of marital infidelity, according to a New York judge ruling on Monday, tersely swatting aside defense claims of prosecutorial misconduct. Assuming the date holds, and it most likely will, the decision from Judge Juan Merchan ensures that the prosecution will be the first of four criminal cases against the former president to reach trial. Trump pleaded not guilty last year to 34 felony counts after allegedly covering up $130,000 in hush money payments made to Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. Mexico's president is claiming the majority of fentanyl is being produced here in the U.S. Well, the Mexican president has had a lot to say of late. Manuel Lopez Obrador, I can never say it quite right, denied claims from the U.S. government that the majority of fentanyl is produced in Mexico and defended his country's traditional family values as a protection against drug abuse in an interview that aired on Sunday. You know why we don't have a drug consumption that you have in the United States? He asked, because we have customs, traditions, and we don't have the problem of the disintegration of the family, end quote. Fentanyl, a synthetic opioid we are all quite familiar with these days, is a major driver in the deadliest drug crisis in U.S. history. More than 100,000 deaths were linked to drug overdoses in 2022, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More than two-thirds involved fentanyl or similar synthetic drugs. Mexico's president, he calls out the United States drug problem, blaming the U.S. for promoting the disintegration of the family. Fentanyl is produced in the United States, he said, in Canada and in Mexico, and the chemical precursors come from Asia. Since fiscal year 21, over 11 million illegal migrants have entered the United States. According to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection data, 9.4 million foreign nationals illegally entered the country in fiscal year 21, 22, and 23, I should say years, and through the end of February of 2024, including another more than 2 million gotaways combined. That total is an estimated 11.4 million, more than the population of 43 U.S. states. They also total more than the population of all individual U.S. cities, including the largest city of New York City, and are greater than the populations of roughly 150 countries. With February's record of 256,094 illegal border crossers and more than 120,000 gotaways in the first quarter of fiscal year 24, the number of illegal border crossers in fiscal 24 through February total more than 1.6 million, the highest in U.S. history. Do we have a problem? I would think so. Well, Massachusetts is spending about $75 million a month on shelter and is reportedly on track to run out of cash next month as officials struggle to contend with a migrant crisis there. Democrat Governor Mara Healey's administration has not revealed exactly when the money is slated to run out, but is expected to be sometime in early or mid-April. That's according to the Boston Herald. Massachusetts had seen an influx of thousands of migrants in recent months that has strained the state's shelter system as well as its finances. About 7,500 families are currently living in emergency assistance shelters, and another 240 families are currently living at state overflow sites. Those numbers do not take into account the thousands more single migrants and homeless Americans housed in the shelters. The Boston Herald weighs in, saying the Senate voted Thursday to give Healey access to up to $840 million over fiscal years 24 and 25 to pay for shelter costs, while the House approved earlier this month a $245 million injection only this fiscal year. Both bills cap time in shelter at 9 months with different rules for extraordinary stays. California's fast food restaurants are planning to cut jobs and hours ahead of the minimum wage increase in April. Well, who could have seen this coming? Well, anyone who, you know, did the math. The Wall Street Journal reports that a California state law is set to raise fast food workers' wages in April to $20 an hour. Some restaurants there are already laying off staff and reducing hours for workers as they try to cut costs. Other operators said that they have halted hiring or are scaling back workers' hours. Some pizza chain operators in California are laying off drivers ahead of the wage laws start and farming out delivery service to apps. Franchises for Pizza Hut and Round Table Pizza, the chain of around 400 units founded in Menlo Park, California, have said that they plan to lay off around 1,280 delivery drivers this year, according to records that major employers must submit to the state before large layoffs. The coming minimum wage increase for California fast food workers at bigger chains represent a 25% increase from the state's broader $16 minimum wage. McDonald's, Chipotle Mexican Grill, Jack in the Box, and other restaurant chains have said that they would raise menu prices in California to offset some of the cost. Many California restaurant operators are looking for other ways to cover the cost, like reducing hours, closing during slower parts of the day, or serving menu items that take less time to make. The Boston Task Force on Reparations called on white churches to step up and pay the black community back for racial inequities that root back to the transatlantic slave trade. In February, the Boston activists called for the city to fully commit to writing checks and for a $15 billion payout since the city's wealth was built on slavery. Racial justice leaders are now demanding that $15 billion from Boston and additional cash from white churches. Florida has banned social media for minors under 14. Well, on Monday, Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law a bill that bars children under the age of 14 from having social media accounts. DeSantis contended that the law was needed to protect children's development. Being buried in those devices all day is not the best way to grow up, he pointed out, what everybody already knows. It's not the best way to get a good education, end quote. Well, Florida's House Speaker Paul Renner echoed the governor by explaining a child in their brain development doesn't have the ability to know that they're being sucked into these addictive technologies and to see the harm and step away from it. And because of that, we have to see the harm and step in for them. With this legislation, Florida becomes the first state to enact an outright ban on social media access for kids. Objections to the new law have been raised by some who claim it violates free speech and privacy rights. Renner anticipates that lawsuits will be raised against the law, but he said, we're going to beat them and we're never, ever going to stop, end quote. Boeing's CEO will resign. We'll tell you more about that in just a few moments. I'll take a drink and cough a little bit. I'll be fine. We're going to be back in just a few moments for our final segment. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgene Rice Show. Well, Boeing's CEO will resign. Hasn't done so yet, but he will. He's been having a bad couple of years, and this year, the string of in-flight incidents with its airplanes, highlighted by Air Alaska's door blowout, culminated in former quality control engineer turned whistleblower John Barnett turning up dead of an apparent suicide. Well, thanks to these incidents, Boeing has seen its stock drop by 25% since the beginning of the year. Also, the company is facing a National Transportation Safety Board investigative hearing in August. Something had to give, and on Monday, what gave was CEO Dave Calhoun, who announced his resignation effective at the end of the year. Will Calhoun's exit be enough to turn Boeing's fortunes around? Well, not according to Ray Goforth, executive director of the Society for Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace. He says the problems in the Boeing's executive suite are systematic. He contends nothing is going to change for the better without company leadership acknowledging their failures and thoroughly committing to fixing them. So keep your eye on what happens at Boeing. After the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, sending the issue of abortion back to the states, the Journal of the American Medical Association conducted a study on at-home abortion pills. Well, the recently released study purports to show that an increase in the demand for such pills offset the decline in the number of abortions performed in 2022. The study is intended to support the Biden administration's decision to pull back regulations on the at-home abortion pill, a case that is before the Supreme Court today. Concerns whether the FDA's policy change to permit greater access to these abortion pills is constitutional. Now, constitutional as opposed to in the best interest of the patient. Well, the trouble with the study is that it relies heavily on data that is either estimated or self-reported. Furthermore, the study's conclusion is undermined by increasing birth rate numbers in places like Texas following the state's adoption of heartbeat legislation that's prevented most abortions there. Well, this report is an example of politics influencing or determining research outcomes rather than research influencing politics. Well, James Carville tells more uncomfortable truths about his own party. It's an election year, and that means many things, one of which is that James Carville, the crazy old uncle of the Democrat Party, is once again ranting and raving about what's become of his once proud party. Well, Carville's recent wisdom about what ails the Democrats has often been spot on, but it never fails to go down, well, like Ipecac syrup. For example, when he was asked about Joe Biden's consistently terrible poll numbers, the Ragin' Cajun, as he named himself, said, when I look at these polling numbers, it's like walking in on your grandma naked. You can't get the image out of your mind, end quote. Carville will likely never again utter anything as memorable as "It's the economy, stupid," but Naked Granny is pretty close. Well, on the matter of today's Democrat Party causing white males and men generally to recoil in disgust, he said, and I quote, "A suspicion of mine is that there are too many preachy females saying, in essence, don't drink beer, don't watch football, don't eat hamburgers. This is not good for you. Everything you're doing is destroying the planet. You've got to eat your peas," end quote. Well, Carville laments this hostile female takeover in other ways. Again, quoting, "If you listen to Democratic elites, NPR is my go-to place for that. The whole talk is about how women and women of color are going to decide this election. I'm like, well, 48% of the people that vote are males. Do you mind if they have some consideration?" End quote. Well, finally, after predictably unhinging attacks on Donald Trump, he returned to the wokeness of his own. And I quote, "No one wants to live like this," he said. "Whoever thought it was a good idea to tell people you can't hug them, or that you've got to be careful, or you've got to think about names to call them other than the name you know them by. There's nothing wrong with me being white, or being white, or you being white, or them being black, or me being male, or you being female. It's a giant, stupid argument," end quote. Well, he's made a point. Boston has a bad history on race. One need only revisit the busing riots in the 1970s to confirm that. But sometimes the pendulum can swing back too far. And that's precisely what appears to have happened recently, as civil rights activists are asking the city's white churches to join the interfaith movement for reparations. As Nothaby helpfully reminds us, slavery has been illegal in Massachusetts since 1783, the full generation before that. In the 1750s, slaves were 2.2% of the population. So there's that. "We point to them," and again quoting from Nothaby, "we point to them in Christian love to publicly atone for the sins of slavery, and we ask them to publicly commit or to process of reparations where they will extend their great wealth, tens of millions of dollars among some of those churches, into the black community," Reverend Kevin Patterson said. If this weren't enough, the Boston Herald reports that the Bay State is spending about $75 million every month on state-run shelters, a massive jump in expenses that comes as Governor Maura Healey administration is expected to run out of cash for emergency services in early to mid-April without another financial infusion. So the math just simply does not add up, even if it were an ethical move. A funny thing happened in the headlong race to eliminate fossil fuels: intersectionality. To elaborate, it seems that a British activist from the radical group Just Stop Oil told her colleagues during a meeting that they needed to fix their flawed reputation as a white middle-class group of activists and focus more on being inclusive to all. Well, as The Blaze reports, the activist, known only as Olive, has been pictured in anti-oil protests, including when the group halted traffic on the London Bridge in June of 23. A reporter infiltrated the eco group's weekly strategy discussion over meetings software Zoom, where the team of environmentalists opined about its public image. We're not sure what to make of all of this, other than reminding ourselves that things here could always be worse. Well, Trump's net worth hit $6.5 billion, making him one of the world's 500 richest people. Team Biden is building a mass operation to take down third-party candidate RFK, who they fear could cost him the election. And by the way, he announced his vice presidential pick earlier today. House Republicans are probing CIA interference in the Hunter Biden investigation. And Bidenflation and Bidenomics are deeply unpopular with women. Church attendance has declined in most U.S. religious groups, and 4,000 acres of solar panels were destroyed in one Texas hailstorm. Locals are now worried about groundwater poisoning. It's not one thing, it's another. Well, on this day in history, 1812, an earthquake devastates Caracas, Venezuela, causing an estimated 26,000 deaths, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. 1827, Ludwig von Beethoven died in Vienna. 1945, during World War II, Iwo Jima is fully secured by U.S. forces following a final attack by Japanese soldiers. 1962, the U.S. Supreme Court in Baker versus Carr gives federal courts the power to order reappointment of states' legislative districts. 1967, Pope Paul VI issues an encyclical, Popularum Progressio on the progressive development of peoples, in which he expresses concern for those trying to escape hunger, poverty, endemic disease, and ignorance. 1979, a peace treaty is signed by Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and witnessed by President Jimmy Carter at the White House. 1988, Jesse Jackson, two very different characters, stuns fellow Democrats by soundly defeating Michael Dukakis in Michigan's Democratic presidential caucuses. Jesse James was not present. 1992, a judge in Indianapolis sentences former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson to 6 years in prison for sexually assaulting Miss Black America contestant. Tyson would end up serving 3 years. 1997, the bodies of 39 members of the Heaven's Gate techno-religious cult who committed suicide are found inside a rented mansion in Rancho Santa Fe, California. 2009, President Barack Obama holds an internet town hall from the White House as he makes a direct sales pitch for his $3.6 trillion budget. Also in 2009, a Soyuz capsule carrying a Russian and American crew and U.S. billionaire space tourist Charles Simonyi blasts off for the International Space Station. Also in 2009, all-star Major League Baseball shortstop Miguel Tejada, he receives a sentence of a year's probation for misleading Congress about an ex-teammate's use of performance-enhancing drugs. 2013, Italy's top criminal court overturns the acquittal of American Amanda Knox and the murder of British roommate Meredith Kircher and orders Knox to stand trial again. 2018, the Commerce Department says the 2020 U.S. Census would include a question about citizenship status. Opponents say the question would discourage immigrants from responding to the census. Also in 2018, a toxicology report obtained by the Associated Press reveals that the late pop music superstar Prince had levels of fentanyl in his body. I remember the announcement and I wondered, what's fentanyl? Well, now we all know that multiple experts describe as exceedingly high. And finally, in 2019, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal, a sweeping Democratic proposal for dealing with climate change, fails to pass the procedural vote as the Senate does not reach the 60 votes necessary to begin debate on the non-binding resolution. Bernie Sanders, along with 42 Democrats, voted present. Well, we are out of time. I do want to thank James Blinn for producing, Dave King for engineering, and thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.